Hey, everybody. I've got a little bit of housekeeping here before we get into the episode about Instagram and Theology Beer Camp. So I've been getting more active on Instagram, and I just want to let you guys know, in case you want to see me make some videos where I look directly into the camera, I'm sharing some stories and posts about basically all the topics that we cover on this show over at Instagram.com/DanKoke. That's C-O-K-E, and the link is in the show notes. Also, Theology Beer Camp is returning in 2024, October 17th through 19th. The theme is Return of the God Pods. That is a Lord of the Rings reference, which should surprise nobody. I will be there alongside Brian McLaren, Diana Butler-Bass, The New Evangelicals, Bible for Normal People, Tony and Josh from GGCH, of course, Trip Fuller and Homebrewed Christianity, and a whole grip of others. And you can use the promo code RETURNOFYHP, all one word, for $25 off your ticket. Prices go up starting June 1st. That link will be in the notes. I hope to see a bunch of you guys there in October. It was a serious highlight of last year for me. My name is Dan Koch. Like many of you, I've been on a complicated faith journey for a number of years now. And while I tend to find myself on the progressive side of Christianity, my goal is not to make liberal converts. I want this show to be a resource for Christians to my right and to my left, as well as former Christians and non-religious folks, anyone who finds themselves asking difficult questions about God, science, prayer, fate, suffering, evangelism, and more. So many of us have been given bad answers to those good questions, often by people with pure intentions. I want to say that you have permission to take both Christianity and the modern world very seriously. And I hope to facilitate that by introducing you to people seeking God across the Christian spectrum, engaging hard questions in a multitude of ways. Thanks for listening. Welcome to You Have Permission, the show that aims to take both Christianity and the modern world very seriously. I'm Dan Koch. I'm a licensed therapist, and today I'm answering a listener question about how I deal with biblical stories depicting a wrathful God. If you're listening to the podcast feed, you should know this is also up on YouTube, where I've got a variety of visual aids to help me answer this question. I'll have a link there in the show notes. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to start with a simple and less interesting answer. Then I'm going to get into some examples of a wrathful God in the Bible. I'm going to introduce the psychological concept of meaning making. I'm going to apply this concept to the biblical writers and then walk through a couple examples of how the lens of meaning making might bring forward interesting or powerful readings from the text. Finally, I'm going to look for some possible areas of application in our own lives. Now, I'm not a biblical scholar. I might get some details or assumptions or maybe consensus picks wrong. And this is also not the only way to wrestle with these passages. It's not the only way to read them profitably, but it's one way that I've noticed myself making sense of them recently, and it falls within the domain of psychology where I'm fairly comfortable. Okay, so let's get to this question. The listener asks, one of the things that's helped me reapproach Christian faith is a new understanding of God's wrath through the lens of folks like yourself, Tom Ord, and Pete Enns. Honored to be listed among them. I'm attracted to the idea that sin, however defined, has intrinsic repercussions rather than extrinsically imposed punishment. Now, let me just say what I take this question asker to mean is that they find compelling the idea that when we sin, when we act selfishly, etc., that action itself produces consequences, alienates us from God, others, alienates us from ourselves. God doesn't have to, quote, punish us, unquote, in some external way. Okay, resuming the question. But as someone who still wants to engage the Bible, I find passages like Psalm 11:5 through 6 all over the place. Quote, "The Lord seeks out the righteous man, but loathes the wicked one who loves injustice. He will rain down upon the wicked blazing coals and sulfur. A scorching wind shall be their lot. That seems pretty kinetic, vengeful, and extrinsically imposed. How do you think about this stuff? I love this question so much. I'll start, as I said earlier, with a simple answer that doesn't get to the really interesting stuff here, which is that this passage in particular, anyway, could be understood through the lens of intrinsic punishment or consequences. It might be that raining down blazing coals and sulfur and being caught up in a scorching wind are to be understood poetically. That by acting unjustly, wickedly, selfishly, individuals call down such things upon ourselves. And I would say, generally speaking, there's a lot of truth to that idea based on my own experience and understanding of the world. Of course, selfish and vindictive people often prosper materially. They often become wealthy or famous or powerful or all three, but they are also often unable to enjoy the life they have built for themselves because essentially their fruit comes from a poisoned tree. So that's one answer. It's poetry, essentially, and this is intrinsic to our experience. But of course, the question asker is right to imply that we find these passages all over Scripture. Indeed, passages that actively describe God bringing real-life consequences for evil behavior. It's a trope to say that they're primarily in the Old Testament, which is true, but they're also in the New Testament. Consider the story in Acts of Ananias and Sapphira, who hold back some of their land from the nascent Christian commune in the very early days of the church, for which they are reportedly struck dead by God directly. Revelation, also in the New Testament, shows us a God who is taking care of all kinds of business, meting out punishment on behalf of the faithful. Revelation 19 specifically depicts Jesus with eyes like flame, astride a white horse up in the clouds, wearing a robe that's been dipped in blood, followed by a heavenly army, all dressed in bright white linen and riding white horses of their own. This Jesus produces a sword from his mouth with which he will rule the world as with a rod of iron, and he will, quote, tread the winepress of the fury of the wrath of God the Almighty. That's the New Testament. Jumping back to the Old Testament or the Hebrew Bible, we can just quickly run through examples of the recurring theme of God handing out violent judgment on individuals, families, and nations who have engaged in evil activities. The flood, Genesis 6 through 8, God judged the entire world because of humanity's wickedness, sparing only Noah and his family. Sodom and Gomorrah, Genesis 19, God destroyed these cities because of their lack of care for the poor. We hear that later in the prophets. And Lot's wife becomes a pillar of salt, ostensibly for looking back at the destruction of her own city instead of keeping her eyes on the prize. The Egyptian plagues, Exodus 7 through 12. God judged Egypt with 10 plagues, culminating in the death of the firstborn of Egypt. This judgment was both a response to Pharaoh's hard-heartedness and a demonstration of God's power over the Egyptian gods. Conquest of Canaan in Joshua, God commanded the Israelites to more or less commit genocide against the Canaanite nations, ostensibly as a judgment for their idolatry, child sacrifice, and other practices. I say ostensibly because there are, of course, other ways to look at that passage. And then there is the exile, first of the northern kingdom of Israel to Assyria, then later the remaining southern kingdom of Judah to Babylon, which is understood by the Israelite biblical authors as God's judgment for their persistent idolatry and disobedience to God's laws. So yeah, this stuff is everywhere in the Bible. Many people, some Christians like myself included, find such a picture of God to be both historically and scientifically implausible and morally problematic. I'm not going to motivate why someone might have those problems. If that is surprising to you, there are some places you could go. You might pick up a book by Pete Enns, who was mentioned earlier here. But I'm speaking to people for either historical, scientific, or moral reasons find this to be a problematic vision of God. So if that's you, how can you find value in such passages? I'm going to share a lens that I have personally found both helpful and explanatory in my own dealing with these passages. And again, since I'm not a biblical scholar, but rather just a licensed therapist, probably not surprising that it is primarily a psychological lens, and that is meaning making. Human beings cannot survive long without a sense of our lives having meaning. Studies suggest that feelings of meaninglessness are associated with alienation and demoralization, which can lead to hopelessness, poor health outcomes, and suicidal thoughts. Contrast this with a sense of meaningfulness. Finding deep meaning in life, in the empirical literature, is associated with better emotional support, life satisfaction, self-efficacy, resilience, lower levels of stress and depression, reduced biological responses to adversity, less emotional distress and suicidal ideation, and improved functioning in various and sundry aspects of life. Okay, so that's meaning itself and feeling like I have a meaningful or meaningless life, this deep need for humans to have meaning. But what then is meaning making? Humans are always constantly, in every single moment, interpreting data from our five senses, that is, our momentary experiences. This new data, then, has to be integrated with everything else in our minds, our beliefs, culture, social context, and our past experiences. This is something that we do without thinking about it. I see a few pieces of wood put together with a plank, and someone is sitting on that plank. I don't have to go, how is this wood creating this object? I go, that's a chair. Someone's sitting on a chair. I know what a chair is. I've got a word for it. I have past history with chairs. This happens unthinkingly. But sometimes this integration of new data with old data is done via storytelling or narrative. So here's a simple example. I drive past a burger joint that I love, and I'm going to go get a burger. But when I get there, I see big pieces of plywood over the windows, and I see a for lease sign. Now, I wasn't expecting this. I was hoping to enjoy a tasty burger. But then I remember, oh yeah, I saw a local news story that this location was closing down. So now the new sense data of what the burger joint looks like today with the boarded up windows, that gets put into a larger story. I used to love this place, then it got closed down, and now I can't eat there anymore. The new information can live peaceably beside the old information. Obviously, that's an example with no stakes, but let's imagine something a lot more disruptive than a restaurant closing. One of the recent events that's been carefully studied by psychologists who are interested in meaning making was Hurricane Katrina. Researchers found that many survivors increased their own resilience by integrating the event into some larger purpose, prompting a reevaluation of their lives. I'd like you to keep those two things in mind. Part of a larger purpose, prompting reevaluation of one's own life. Additionally, survivors who engaged in collective meaning-making with community support tended to recover more effectively, and specifically, faith-based explanations provided comfort, a framework for understanding the event, and a community of support. So let's bring it back to the text that we're talking about. Let's say you are a member of the ancient Israelites trying to make sense of your nation's exile to Babylon. Imagine wanting so desperately to return home to your country. One idea, as you are feeling this, that's circulating around campfires in the evening has been attributed to the prophet Jeremiah. Now, you already know Jeremiah. He was nationally famous before the exile. So everybody's been kind of waiting to hear what Jeremiah might say next. Now, in exile, Jeremiah has described a vision that he's been given from God about an eventual return to the land. And it includes this language. Again, I will build you, and you shall be built, O virgin Israel. Again, you shall take your tambourines and go forth in the dance of the merrymakers. Again, you shall plant vineyards on the mountains of Samaria. The planters shall plant and shall enjoy the fruit. See, I am going to bring them from the land of the north and gather them from the farthest parts of the earth. Among them, the blind and the lame, those with child and those in labor together, a great company, they shall return here. With weeping they shall come, and with consolation I will lead them back. I will let them walk by brooks of water in a straight path in which they shall not stumble." That made it into the Bible. That's Jeremiah 31. And if you're that Israelite in exile, that beautiful scene, it stole your breath. That right there is a reason to live, to persevere. And it doesn't ask you to kill, to commit war atrocities. It's asking you to love and trust your God and recommit yourself to good and right living. Jeremiah's message for what Israel needs to do hasn't changed much. It's still justice for the poor, a renewed singular focus on Yahweh and a forsaking of other gods and religions, and a recommitment to the special covenant made between Yahweh and Israel. Now, you see what this does? What might have started as chaos? Why have we been ripped from our homeland by soldiers who don't give a crap about us? Now, it's got reasons attached as well as a way forward. Remember those two things I noted earlier from the empirical research? Meaning-making after catastrophe can lead to a sense of larger purpose, which prompts a reevaluation of someone's life. That's what's going on here. And since it has reasons and a way forward, now it has meaning. So applying this more broadly to these various depictions of a wrathful God, especially in moments of national or group chaos like the exile, or like the persecution of the early church by the Roman Empire, what people need in these moments is a story into which what they are currently experiencing can make sense. When the Bible was written, it was simply much more common than it was today to believe that more or less everything that happened on the earth could be traced back in some way to divine intervention, divine will, the thoughts and emotions of the gods. Bad year of crops, probably God's judgment. Empire persecuting you? Well, pretty soon here, the skies are going to open up and God's going to deal with those evil people directly. After all, when our ancient Israelite ancestors were themselves cruel, God sent them into exile. So maybe that's what God's going to do now with the Romans. Now, probably most people living in biblical times would have believed these things literally. But earlier, I gave an example of how we might still find value in these descriptions of God by taking them figuratively. We heap burning coals on our own heads metaphorically when we act selfishly or with evil intent. And the meanings that the biblical authors and even the first readers and hearers of these stories, those meanings that they made, they might not satisfy us in the same way as modern people. But that doesn't mean we can't find meaning ourselves. So let's go back to the psalm from the original question. Quote, "The Lord seeks out the righteous man, but loathes the wicked one who loves injustice." Can I find similar meaning in the idea that God is closer to the righteous than to the unjust? Perhaps that next verse about God sending down wicked blazing coals, okay, I'm not sure about that. And like the question asker, I'm not sure that God ever sends any extrinsic punishment to people. But I do like the metaphorical reading there, that I might create a scorching wind for myself through my own actions, as well as for the people around me. Perhaps more importantly, I think that using this lens of meaning making helps me to identify with both the author of the passage, whether that was actually King David or some other gifted Israelite poet, and identify with the early receptors and hearers of these words who sang and prayed them together in years like 550 BC, stuck in captivity in a foreign land. In fact, the Babylonian exile is an interesting example of one of these stories that leads to meaning, because this particular story has survived for millennia and been reinterpreted in many contexts. And here, for example, is something you probably did not expect to hear in an episode about God's wrath and the ancient Israelites. This is the 90s alternative stoner group Sublime, covering the song Rivers of Babylon, which was originally performed by the Jamaican group The Melodians in 1972.
By the rivers of Babylon, where he sat down, and there he went, when he remembered Zion. Oh, but they wicked carry us away.
So the original version of that song was written during a time when that community of Rastafarians was trying to make sense of their own story, tying together long, deep religious roots in Ethiopia and other parts of Africa with the astounding and brutal historical fact of the slave trade, which brought people of African descent to the Caribbean in the first place. Now, neither the Israelites nor the transatlantic African slaves nor the 1970s Rastafarians in Jamaica, none of those stories are my story. Sublime's story isn't even my story, but it's a lot closer to mine. They're from my home state. They're playing music that I loved at a time when I loved it. And through them, I got introduced to the song and clued into this long and beautiful tradition. Because you know where the lyrics for Rivers of Babylon come from? They're taken from Psalm 137, a later psalm written during the Babylonian exile. In that psalm, the captors are forcing the exiled Israelites to sing a song from their homeland, essentially to entertain the conquering Babylonians. Now, students of American history, by which I refer both to slavery and the long history of black music in this country, being forced to sing your own song to entertain your captors, any of that sound familiar? So could that psalmist, writing in the 6th century BC, could he have imagined 13-year-old me, freckled and pimply, sun in, bleaching my hair, checkered straps of my JanSport backpack to show how much I loved ska? Could that guy imagine me in the suburbs of Northern California 2,500 years in the future singing those words? That is meaningful, to me anyway. And considering the biblical text through this lens opens up all kinds of other questions for ourselves about the meaning-making process in general. And if we follow these paths, we can learn more about ourselves. We can learn more about our communities. We can find more beautiful art. I can ask questions like, when have I engaged in this kind of meaning-making, specifically the kind that takes place after great suffering? What was the pain I experienced that required new meaning to be made? Can that give me a window into other people's need for that meaning? When I was so desperate for that meaning in that difficult moment, maybe I made some connections between things that aren't true. They're not literally true. I wouldn't think they're true today even, just a later version of myself. So now let's zoom all the way out to talk about God in the midst of all of this. So, okay, maybe God doesn't directly punish the evil and directly reward the good, like in this verse and others in the Bible. But where do I think God is in all of this? Personally, I find most compelling the idea that God is with the suffering individuals, always and always available for comfort. And one way that suffering individuals get comfort is through making meaning. So is God okay with us sometimes getting the details wrong as we grab whatever is within arm's reach to bandage ourselves up, both individually and communally? If God is love and God is not primarily concerned with us getting all our facts in line, which I think kind of has to be the case, that God is, to me, much more likely to be love than an authoritarian, you know, taskmaster and belief checker. So if that's true of God, then I think God understands human beings the way we are, the way God created us. Just like I understand when my children latch on to pretty incomplete ideas in the moment to help them get through difficult times. So that's my answer to the question. Thank you guys for watching or listening. You can like and subscribe on YouTube or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. There's a link to each of those versions in the show notes for each of those versions. And for anybody listening or watching, you can go to patreon.com/DanCoke for 2 exclusive podcast episodes every month, membership in the Facebook community, and more. Thanks.